Helm, set a course.
Headed.
Engage.
Let's fly.
Welcome, one and all, to Discovery, a Star Trek podcast by Fantastic Geek, your official, unofficial Star Trek podcast. My name is Matt, and joining me, as always, is Pete. Hailing frequencies are open.
Intention is nothing. Outcome is everything. Discovery, a Star Trek podcast by Fantastic Geek for episode 507, Eriga, comes to you now via a goat farm on BoPak 3.
And just a bit of fleet news before we launch into the episode. Pete taking a look at the Marvel Cinematic Universe. This week, we got not one, but two updates for Fantastic Four, a Galactus actor, and a Malkovich casting. No name, no character attached to that. One can assume he's not Galactus, since that's being played by the other guy.
Fresh off the Giancarlo Esposito rumor last week, yeah, they've named Galactus here, so it seems Esposito's playing somebody else. So yeah, we'll have to wait on that. No word on who John Malkovich is playing, but certainly that cast is heating up. And Matt, rumors heating up that not only Ryan Coogler will return for Black Panther 3, but is the preferred candidate to direct the MCU X-Men movie.
Ooh, goosebumps there. Yeah, if anybody's earned it, he has. Yes, across the board for all that. That all sounds like a great idea. And I think of all the fun that we're having with the little snippets coming out in a controlled fashion for the Superman movie. Just the notion of, and so-and-so has been cast. Are they Cyclops? Are they this? Just that whole lead up, that's going to be a ton of fun as we count down to hopefully an X-Men movie or series in the next 2 or 3 years. So exciting news there.
To Star Wars, Matt, where episode one overperformed at the box office, finishing second last week, this in a one-week engagement for the 25th anniversary re-release.
Yeah, $8.7 million, second place behind The Fall Guy, which itself fell from its estimates. So I am a bit surprised that The Phantom Menace did as well as it did, just given as how one would think that all the fans already have it on. I don't know if it was ever on VHS. It probably was the waning days of VHS, but certainly, you know, DVD and Blu-ray and streaming and this and that. But
it's also the top global performer on Disney Plus.
Yeah, you know, I saw that too, where all of a sudden it was, you know, it tickles me pink. And just the notion that, look, Pete, if I know you know this, if our listeners didn't know, given as how, because of the strike, a lot of studios have pushed movies out of this year and into next year, the solution that the studios are doing is trotting out re-releases that might not make a ton of money. But Pete, Disney made, well, I don't know, $5 million off this episode one re-release. You know, the theater's getting the rest. So for what? For putting it out there? For having a few ads? It's kind of win-win-win across the board.
I think the secondary effect there, getting people prepped for The Acolyte. But speaking of preparation, Matt, as the Mandalorian and Grogu movie moves ever closer to production, Sigourney Weaver confirmed to be in talks.
Yeah, that would be a super fun addition. It's also in this weird gray area that usually when those announcements are made in talks, it's like, it's a done deal, but not done deal, you know. But it's not like, oh man, she was invited to Disney HQ for coffee. Like, it's farther along than that. But whatever role you can get her, whatever she's wanting to play, I think it would be a great addition to that film.
And now, Matt, for a little segment I like to call This Week in Paramount Misery.
Pete, a through line with all of these delays for Paramount, the through line seems to be Shari Redstone, the controlling stockholder and so forth, it's kind of like she needs to be happy with the deal and she wants everything to stay the same in this world where people, rightly or wrongly, are saying, you're doing it wrong. Having cable and broadcast and streaming and owning theaters and, you know, they've more recently gotten rid of the publishing. Like, the model has changed. You need to chop all this up. And she's saying, no, Pete, I'm not the one that owns all this, so I'm not here to say what the right answer is. But it's just, it continues to be a weird thing that she might turn her nose up at both of the deals that we keep discussing, because both of the deals aren't similar enough to just continuing with doing what's been done, even though that's losing money. And I will add to this, Pete, the notion that Disney Plus and Hulu and Max are going to be bundled together. That does put pressure in my mind for the leftovers. I'm not counting Netflix, of course. Netflix top dog, Disney and Max kind of joining forces as a bundle. That's your second place behemoth. It does place pressure on Paramount Plus with 75 million subscribers and Peacock with 25 million subscribers. It puts pressure on them to do something, like to bundle, to merge, to play nice together, not to directly compete with each other.
So while we wait, Matt, for closure that may never come, we talk about Star Trek.
Indeed, Pete. It's why we're here, and let's head into this week's mission briefing.
A recording of Maul advertising a special offer on courier services for a limited time only echoes as the Terran warp pod she and Locke escaped in hangs in the USS Lockerer's tractor beam when Discovery jumps in. Commander Nahn says the message was broadcast on subspace frequency Epsilon 19, which Burnham confirms is a courier channel, adding special offer is code for SOS. Admiral Vance has tasked Nahn to assist security as they transfer Maul and Locke to Fed HQ. Nahn found Dr. Velik's diary on Maul and hands it over to Burnham. They already had some of it on file, but can now start translating the rest. And Nahn even has a Romulan on her team. As the doors open, Book is trying to get past security, and Burnham notes he's not supposed to be there. But he heard Maul and Locke are beaming over. Nahn says Vance must okay whoever sees them. Book thinks his connection to Maul can get her to talk. Nahn notes she nearly killed him on the Enterprise, but Book points out she didn't, and he wants a chance. Nahn recaps how the last time she saw Book, he fired on Discovery and set off an isolytic weapon, but he reminds her he's been working to make things right.
Nahn and Burnham enter this place, which is revealed to be sickbay, as Locke has been wounded. Maul and Locke will be beamed in together. They will be kept inside a containment field. Culber is ready to examine Locke. We are reminded that Maul blames Burnham for all of this trouble. Nahn pulls the guards back. The beaming happens. The containment field goes up. And Culber takes a look at things and then advises Burnham of the following privately. That a vital organ has been hit. Not quite sure what it is. There's just simply not enough known about the Breen race. It's observed that it would be bad optics if a Breen dies while in Federation custody. One solution from what they say is the Dominion War, they also mean the Deep Space Nine era, is doing some cold storage. So let's get that together. Let's jump. Let's get everything prepped. And indeed, Pete, they start prepping.
Yes, though it is a long shot. Burnham beams out to the bridge and Discovery jumps to HQ. She tells Commander Asha to dock, but they've been asked to wait. Lieutenant Christopher explains Vance wants to speak to Burnham and it's classified, which means that everyone on the bridge must look at each other.
Thus is the way of visual storytelling. We have a Breen warning, hand over the two with the Erega or else. Handing them over, however, is not an option. Burnham cannot believe that the Fed would lie about Moll and Locke. She proposes meeting them head on, dialogue, finding a solution. Pete, maybe I've been grumpy lately with this show. I wanted to be eye-rolly. Pete, maybe I'm just pessimistic from the troubles of our real world, but this is the Star Trek solution. This is the reminder that maybe through dialogue we can work together and find a common ground. Vance okays it and hopes it will work. We head into the credits. This is an episode written by M. Raven Metzer, one of the best forces of the worst Marvel Netflix show, that is Iron Fist. I believe he was the showrunner and great improverer of the second season there. And this episode directed by John Dudkowski.
Four pieces of the puzzle in the credits, Matt. And afterward, President Tarina thanks Vance, Burnham, and Rayner for coming so quickly to the conference room, where she says Rilik has delegated her to lead negotiations, and she's reviewed all records of contact with the Breen, none since before the Burn existing. Intel indicates unrest since their emperor died, with six, count them, Matt, six. We know the sixth Primarch at war for their Imperium. Burnham asks if they know which is coming, which they don't. Rayner claims they're all the same. Diplomacy isn't in their vocabulary, but the steely Tarina says they'll teach it to them and wants to offer them something to negate the Erega. Rayner reminds them it's a blood bounty, and they will start a war to fulfill it. Vance says Starfleet was caught flat-footed the last time the Breen entered their space, and he's called back some of their ships. They just need to keep the calm until backup arrives. Burnham notes the risk the Breen are taking to get Maul and Locke, and they need more info. Tarina tells them Saru, like Rilik, is on a mission and can't even come to a screen in this episode.
Indeed, Pete, word in the last week that Doug Jones said his time away from the show was in order to do press for Hocus Pocus 2. I'm not quite sure of the math. Why, let's say you're doing one Discovery a week, and probably they're more like an 8-9 day shooting schedule with maybe time off on the weekends, time off on Sundays, something like that. I don't know why Doug Jones would need to be away for a month, and you can't in any way figure out how to have his character in there. But, well, Pete, is there a kinder, gentler, more honest soul than Doug Jones? I dare say not. So we will take him at his word there.
Definitely told us where he didn't need to.
Regardless, this idea of the Breen fighting over succession is repeated by Tarina, which we did also cover in the earlier scene. Had me wondering why. Rayner again is ready to fight the fight. Tarina worries, however, that to fight the fight would indeed lead to a fight, a war, and so forth. He says that he is not xenophobic. Instead, it is the Breen that see genocide as their prime directive. It is with this vitriol that Rayner gets booted from the roundtable meeting. And Burnham just wants to get information out of Maul and Locke. After all, she was with them on the ISS. Yes, just the ISS. In editing, did they get rid of the
International Enterprise? Space Station?
Like, it's like saying, Pete, you know what ship caught Maul and Locke at the beginning of this episode? It was the USS. And at first I was like, okay, maybe they, for pacing or whatever, they dropped Sonequa Martin-Green saying the ISS Enterprise. They then do it later on in the episode. Like, it's such a weird choice, and I don't think it's in line with, like, again, as you were saying, Pete, it's literally USS. I don't know if it's ever officially defined in Star Trek. We all assume it's United Spaceship or something like that. But it, again, it's like saying, Pete, did you see the landing on aircraft carrier? As opposed to, did you see the aircraft, the landing on the aircraft carrier forward? You know, it's weird. It's weird.
On the SS.
Indeed.
The space station. Yeah. Vance authorizes this plan that Burnham has proposed and tells her to keep Rainer in line because they can't afford any missteps when the Preen arrive. Rainer meets Burnham outside and he pushes back on Vance's approach, but she says they're concerned about his ability to handle the situation and think it's personal. She also wants any intel he might have about the Breen, but he said what he had to, and she dismisses him, telling Lieutenant Gallo to take the Discovery to Yellow Alert and prepare for the Breen. Phaser in hand, Tilly is stopped on Discovery by Stamets, who was looking for her in the science lab, but she wants to protect her cadets at HQ. He holds up the Beta Z logo they retrieved from the fifth tower on Halemno that they have translated as the Labyrinths of the Mind. He wants her and Adira to focus on that, and he'll work on the properties of the metal in the card. Tilly expands on the Breen's last visit to Federation space when they destroyed an entire city. Stamets says the Mitchell is out there with orders in case Discovery sends an encrypted message if they fail, making the clue the most important thing in the Federation right now. They have to get the progenitor's power to safety. He says HQ is the safest place for her cadets and gets her to help.
I really appreciate this notion of the kind of the fail-safe nature of the mission. Look, it's called Star Trek Discovery. We know it's the seventh episode of the season. Maybe when they're filming, they don't know that it's the final season, et cetera, et cetera. But we kind of know most of our heroes are going to make it all the way to the end of the season most of the time. That's the nature of it all. Nonetheless, I appreciate the conceit of, like, if we die here, others shall take up the cause because it is up to the Federation to protect the progenitor tech, and we are the most noble ones to do so. Like, this is all good stuff to add weight to the story, weight that probably doesn't exist. I don't think that we're going to have the Mitchell find the last clue and save the galaxy. It's probably going to be the USS Discovery on Star Trek Discovery. But this is good job, M. Raven Metzer, writer of this episode. We go back to sick bay, where Burnham explains that the Breen are on their way. What was your plan, Maul and Locke? Maul is ready to simply wing it. It is wondered, what could the payment be that they would offer besides the bounty on their heads? Locke says nothing. Burnham notes the Breen dreadnought is coming. Why is the Primarch so angry? I have to confess, Pete, I know we had the flashback episode. And again, I don't mean to go from praising to critical, but, like, because we had the flashback, I know why the Primarch is angry with Locke, the whole nephew dealio. I know there's a bit more sketched out here, but I felt like we were in this in-between place in terms of dramatic tension. We know more than Burnham, which is a weird place to put we, the audience.
Well, it's also that they won't respond in the interrogation that allows her to put everything together, right? Like, oh, wait, he needs you. What are you? You know, the sun, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Finally, Burnham piecing this together that he's the key to succession, not the uncle. And Locke confirms it here, right? Direct descendant of the Emperor, scion of the Imperium, which he also says makes him feel sick to say. He doesn't want the throne. And he asks Burnham to spit in his uncle's face when he arrives. Zora has matched the phrase on the clue card to a Beta Z manuscript written in 2371 by Dr. Marina Derricks, one of the other scientists, but only a few thousand were published, and none seem to still be available. Adira says there must be one floating around someplace, but Zora says the punctuation points to them needing the original handwritten copy. Adira asks Zora to search for ancient manuscript experts, and Tilly compliments Adira on the job they are doing. Zora's search reveals Reno has experience as a rare antiquarian bookseller. They find her repairing a targeting matrix, but she may have padded her resume there a little bit, as she used to move hard-to-find folios for a shady archivist. She was also a VIP shuttle pilot, a deep mercury welder, and a bartender in an Echelon 4 dive before Starfleet. She's actually covering at Reds tonight. While she's never heard of Labyrinths of the Mind, Reno says there's a lot of places it could be, but they're interrupted by an announcement. The brain are arriving and soon shadowed by its mass.
Tig Notaro, so wonderful in this scene, particularly her criticism of the Breen, what with their truncheons and jackboots, lacking nuance and so forth. Also the delivery of her bartender drink, Seven of Limes, sublime in its humor. But as you say, Pete, the dreadnought has arrived. I appreciate the scale of it. That's a big old dreadnought there. Enough to take us to an act break. When we come back, Burnham says that is the ship that destroyed Fed HQ in the Time Bug Adventure. Burnham shares with Tarina that Locke is the key to the bloodline. Now it's time to talk to the Breen. It's Primarch Ruhn, R-U-H-N, pronounced ruin, like, you know, can spoil everything. You see, Pete, I think they did an alien spelling of the word R-U-I-N to show how he's just willing to ruin the whole place to get what he wants because he's a bad guy.
He is showing up here on the hail, the translation identifying him and demanding the prisoners without negotiation. Tarina asks for 4 hours and is given one, but Burnham has an idea. In engineering, Stamets is trying to narrow down the metal of the clue card when Book finds him to help. Given that he's only narrowed the needle down to 100 million haystacks, anything should be of assistance here. Meanwhile, Burnham goes to Raynor as they're running out of time and reveals she found out Kelleran was used as a Breen outpost. It was a long time ago and something he doesn't like to talk about. He doesn't know Ruhn, but Primarch T'Hall controlled Kelleran as a forward base and resupply hub, clear-cutting forests, poisoning seas, and blackening skies. They fought hard, but he was the only one of his family who survived. He says the Breen can't be negotiated with when they want something. Burnham thinks Raynor has helped her and thanks him.
Yeah, she thanks him for sharing this context and background related to his direct experience with the Breen. That same sharing is what got him booted from the earlier round table. Now, if you want to say, okay, dramatic conceit, so be it. And I grant you, you know, the story does change a bit if she doesn't have that information. But like, hey, when you kicked the guy out of the meeting earlier on, floating the idea that he was racist as opposed to has direct experience with how the Breen can take marginalized people and just grind them up under their boots. Oh, thank you for sharing now. Why didn't you share earlier? Oh, it's because I kicked you out of the meeting. I was not happy with Captain Burnham's leadership choice in the earlier
Could
scenes.
Be a function. So M. Raven Metzner, and this is a common practice with writers' rooms, he may have been brought in as kind of like a hired gun and may not necessarily have access to story points earlier in the season. Advance and Rayner have a 30-plus year association. Is it doubtful that Vance wouldn't know, oh, hey, you're Kelleran, and here's what happened to your planet, and all that? I did like how they were couching Rayner's grumpiness, and then Tarina, the idea here, wait, you're going to say a Romulan saying about Breen, like, no, we're the Federation, man. We're not going to be xenophobic. Like, to me, all of that worked. And then in this, you know, navel-gazing moment where the Kelleran is looking at the ship of the people we now learn have, you know, at one point occupied his home world, that's the most effective and dramatic place for this info to come out.
While I think you and I are disagreeing as to the real-world writerly execution of these scenes, I think we're 100% agreeing that in-universe, Rayner's anger is justified, and it's, you know, that round table is lesser because they did not listen to and contextualize his understanding. So in that sense, Pete, we're all winners. We go back to Reno. She has no contacts now, 800 years later, in the world of antique books. The manuscript's unique nature is recapped. Reno does wonder about the Eternal Gallery and Archive. It's a neutral place for rarities to be protected. It's in space. It's always on the move. Maybe that medal that you have is a library card. And again, Pete, I doff my cap. Much like last week, I like the idea that the plain old water is both the clue and also, like, there is no clue in the water. You need to think it through. I like that we, again, have this physical thing, the piece of metal, that doubtless next week it's going to be scanned or whatever it is. It's going to open up the proper vault to get us to the book and all of that. It's just a neat way to do another clue as opposed to, look, it's another map. We need to find the spot that has the this, the that, the other, and have Zora scan it, and now we go there. It's a great way to do a clue.
As Reno notes, sounds like something out of a holodeck adventure for the littles. Culber tells Locke he's not out of the woods, but stable. He warns it's a mistake for Burnham to play Rune because Breens don't think like humans, but Culber thinks there's always common ground, like Maul and Locke's relationship. But Locke says Maul loves him because of his differences, not despite them, which he did not think was possible. Maul says that Locke needs rest, and Culber exits the containment field. Maul tells Locke they can't let Rune get them before they have the progenitor's tech, and he tells her to steal a shuttle and beam him over. She's not going to like his plan to get the drop on the Starfleet guards and out of the containment field.
Back to headquarters. It's time to go with the plan as planned. The Breen ship is hailed with the message that the Federation is ready to hand the fugitives over. The Breen beam over, lots and lots of Breen beam. Introductions are made, and the prisoners are demanded. Tarina notes that she still does have a little bit left of the hour that the Breen gave. So since we have the time, let's have a conversation. She also notes, in a wonderful moment here, that the translator for the Breen isn't as good as Tarina translating. You know, that the translator is being a little diplomatic in his own wording here. So let's get it right, fools. There's a new offer made, 45 metric tons of dilithium to lift the Erica. The Federation wants to avoid conflict and thinks that the Breen should view it all through that lens. Diplomatic relations may have failed here in this conversation. So Tarina says, let's deal instead with Primarch T'Hall. And maybe T'Hall can use Locke to get a boost to the throne. Pete, It's diplomacy. It's having the conversation. This is a great scene.
Yeah, I'm going to have my spear beamed in now and stomp it, placing everyone on alert. Rune calls their offer a lie and a bluff, but Rainer uses details of T'Hall's occupation of his world to sell it, including her admiration of the way he fought, almost like a Breen. Tarina knows Rune can't risk harm coming to Locke. As Maul asks to talk to Murnum, Locke messes with a liquid in the biobed, screaming in agony. Culber tells the security guards to lower the containment field and says that he took an entire day's dose. Locke tells Maul to go, and she detaches a tube, filling sickbay with mist, attacking the guards in a series of interesting shots by the director here. Culber tries to stop her, and she stuns him. Nan enters, and they fight before Maul hides in the mist and then leaping at her.
Back to the Breen, Ruin will give more than T'Hall, so bring Locke. Tarina suggests that perhaps both offers will be rejected and all can leave in peace. In keeping Locke, the status quo will be maintained, and a Breen versus Breen battle is kept internal, i.e. not bringing in the Federation. That is, unless, Ruin, you think you cannot win a Breen versus Breen battle. Again, this is just, on a certain level, this is standard Vulcan logic, but this is all being executed in a really novel, entertaining, cerebral way. And this challenge gives Ruin pause. Burnham steps away as Nan pages her. Burnham goes to sickbay, learning the situation, including that, you know, 50% of the prisoners of the Breen Want are now missing. The other one may die. Nan is going to take the lead to find Maul. It's confirmed that Locke is in bad shape. Time to get the Primarch. Time to get some help as we go into an act break.
As Zora announces lockdown protocol, Book bets it's because of Maul and finds that ship schematics were accessed 30 seconds ago on Deck 5. He wants to go, but Stamets talks him down to work on the clue card and proposes he use his empathic abilities to read any residual thoughts on it. In another interesting shot, Book lights up his forehead and sees empty space, a huge plasma storm, and noises like plasma bursts. Stamets says the ionic discharge created would certainly help them narrow down a possible location. As he goes to look for Maul, Book says there was a feeling of eternity or something eternal as well. As Culber tries to help Locke, Burnham beams back with a Breen medic, with news that a Breen medic is on the way with Rune, who asks where Maul is, and Burnham bluffs she's being held elsewhere. He says if Locke dies, he will hold the Federation responsible as the medic gets to work in his black leather skirt thing.
We go back to Book and Nan on the search, finding Maul. There's nowhere to go. And Locke might not make it. Book takes over the discussion here, talking about what it feels like to lose the one you love. We flash to some loving moments of tenderness. No, this isn't how the story ends. But we have Locke flatlining his story ending, ? Such a question takes us to an act break, and afterwards, Rune is angry. The Federation is to blame for the death of Locke. Battle shall come. All pause, looking scared. Tarina knows they're about to fight, and Vance calls for a red alert. Rainer says that we should fight first. But good news, there's more Starfleet on the way. It's a modest quartet of ships. A bit of a change since the Battle of the Binary Stars that started this show off. But a noble little fleet here. back in sickbay, it's reiterated that the stimulant had been used to try and free Maul and by extension Locke. But Rune is ready to use Locke in death, if not in life. And Maul will be joining him in death. If only, Pete, there was some sort of dramatic reveal that could upend the situation.
Yes, rolling up her sleeve here to reveal a raised branding on her and Locke's wrists, indicating a marriage, which obligates Rune to take her. She tells him the Federation is hiding something from them so great he won't need Locke to claim the throne, and only she can help him get it. Rune decides he wants Maul after all, and gives them 5 minutes to transport her over before all the brain beam back here. At HQ, Book says Maul isn't thinking straight. But Burnham disagrees and says she has a plan, that being Maul. Nan and her team did translate the rest of the diary. And she recaps the detail about the progenitors' technology not only creating life, but with the possibility of reviving the dead, which the moment Locke died, you were kind of like, yeah, that's not the last time we're seeing him. Burnham says that's why Maul is doing this. Rayner points out that Maul doesn't have the Halemno clue, though. Book says they cannot consider giving Maul to the Breen, but Tarina comes down on the side of letting her go. Vance nods, and Maul's containment field falls, and she's beamed away. Book tells Burnham it's wrong and leaves.
Back to Team Science. High five. They're headed to the archive. Everybody works together. Everybody's sharing info. And where is this place? Because if you chart where the archive has been, boop, 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 you can see all these locations. It's been in a line. Why? They're headed to the Badlands, which you might remember from Star Trek The Next Generation, Star Trek Voyager, Star Trek Deep Space Nine, because we all love Star Trek. As we prepare to jump, Burnham and Rayner have a heart-to-heart. He did well today, and together they'll fight for a better tomorrow. And Pete, as we have ended so many episodes with momentum to take us to next week, we are on the bridge, ready to jump, with all the things and all the stuff ready for the next adventure. Black alert to end this week's tale. Pete, we have an incoming threat analysis. Why, look who's on the space radar. It's Primarch Ruin.
I sure hope he doesn't ruin the season for the Federation.
I like his use here, and I know I was a little down earlier in the episode in the fact we've gotten some flashback info, but fair is fair. We did not have the entire complete picture, and we learned more about the fighting Primarchs, and all of that works here. It's a good threat. It's not a lengthy list of threats this week. It's not the five that we had last week, but it all runs through Primarch Ruin, and he's done a great job keeping the plot moving.
The interesting aspect of the marriage, you wonder what the relationship is. So he's Locke's uncle, right? So is, if Locke is direct descendant, is he the prince of the Breen Imperium? Was he the son of the emperor? Like, what exactly is that? I mean, it's clear, it's stated, he doesn't want it. You know, he's the one that's figured out the way they live isn't for him, and you know, he's had this relationship blossom with Maul. You know, you wondered when we first got the Primarch, okay, he just doesn't see eye to eye with a relative. And now the idea that he was stuck on, you know, shuttle bay duty. Oh, all right, maybe the Emperor hadn't died yet, somebody I need to hold on to. But even the Erega was declared back then, so maybe the infighting was already happening.
I feel like these episodes have continued to keep the Breen as this kind of mysterious them. You know, we're far from the Star Trek Next Generation Klingon culture episodes. I think there's a little appropriate hand waving going on saying, oh, it's his uncle. Like, I agree, Pete, in Earth and European terms, the uncle is the prince of the, is the brother of the, and if you just say, oh, the Breen do things differently, but he's the uncle and he needs the, like, kind of Right. Everything as presented, it functions as it is, even if we don't understand the whole tree of succession. Let's set our long-range sensors to scan for some theories. Pete, episode 8, episode 9, episode 10. That's what's left for us.
Must you remind me, we have only 3 left. Like, it's bad enough. It's the shortest season of Discovery ever. But now we're down to just 3 left.
Do we see... I mean, clearly next week is to go to the Badlands to get this final piece. Do you think that next week's adventure is the adventure of getting the piece, and then the week after that is we've put it all together? What's next, or do you speed things up from there? What's your thought?
So I had sent you, they've advertised on social media again, Matt. I don't know if it had anything to do with the email we got last week, but they're going to do another screening. They're going to do the finale in a theater in Beverly Hills a couple hours before everybody else sees it. So make sure you go there on a Wednesday night so you can see it, like, I think 2.5 hours before it's available for everybody else.
It's a weird... I mean, that feels slightly half-hearted. On the one hand, look, do I appreciate the fact that people aren't going to roll on out of there on a Monday night and go, oh man, and here's the conclusion, and here's this, and here's that. You know, okay, I appreciate that. You know, flip side, having been to the Strange New Worlds season 1 premiere, I mean, I don't know that stuff was out there. We saw it. We did our bit where we said, hey, here's our non-spoilery thoughts. Like I don't know. Like, we're all big enough.
Nothing like that. And that was significantly before those episodes hit. In fact, we saw 2 and they only released 1 a week in all of the first season. So yeah, it just feels, and I have additional stuff, Matt, through Reddit this week, actually responding to our podcast link and people talking about Paramount really not doing a good job of promoting Star Trek in general, especially Discovery.
Let me ask you this, Pete, bringing things back squarely to theories here. A criticism that we've had of this season, at least a criticism I've had, is kind of the, you know, Burnham and a friend go on an adventure while everybody else stays back at the ship. We had an A plot, a B plot, a C plot, a D plot this week with so many characters kind of having a role in the story. Do you think that we get that kind of whole crew story for the next 3 episodes, or is that just a function of this week's episode?
No, I think you're headed to a fairly firm finale, and then the teamwork that has been the hallmark of Discovery, right? Like, yes, you put Tilly and Burnham on a mission last week, and you've had Rainer and her bond over the time book, you know, boondoggle and everything there. I think that's just storytelling. But again, given that, you know, co-showrunner Michelle Paradise has said, well, we wouldn't have changed anything if we knew that it was going to be the end. They didn't go back and let's take this line out because this was for the 6th season when, you know, we give Rainer a whole holodeck program where he likes to go scuba diving or something like that. You know, I think they're going to tack on an epilogue of sorts. We know that, unfortunately, Culber, that Wilson Cruz couldn't participate in that comeback because he had taken a job that put him on the other side of the world to film for a Netflix movie that comes out either later this month or early next month. However, I got super concerned when Malls got him lined up. And then I'm like, oh, wait, they wouldn't kill him twice, right?
Let's hope not. Let's hope not. You mentioned this idea of a filmed epilogue. I would like to again propose, I think that this series will end with a sonorous monologue from Sonequa Martin-Green, pulling in phrases like the human adventure will always continue, talking about our astral journey, boldly going where no one has gone before, forever going on our Star Trek, something like that.
To make Discovery?
Indeed. Like, I feel like that's...
some sort of Enterprise where yeah. they might take a Voyager to Deep Space Nine?
Yeah. Pete, you're taking the shine off what I imagine is just a tears rolling down our cheeks, sort of like thus the new, the old Star Trek manifesto, the new and the old, the reiteration of, you know, working together as one crew for the common good and infinite diversity, infinite combinations. I feel like, you know what, write that monologue, folks. Have written that monologue, have filmed that monologue. Because if we're going to end this show, let it end just on the highest of highs.
I really am anxious to see it. Not in a bad way. I just really want to see what they've done. But given this episode, Matt, and I mentioned it before, Locke's totally coming back to life, right? Like in some sort of quantum genesis torpedo?
Oh, 1,000%. I mean... mention it once, the power of life and death. Okay, great. Now you've invoked it. Perhaps not the necessary three times. The third time will be, and look, it is the code to do life and
it
death.
It was the second specific mention of, wait, not just create life, but bring it back.
Yeah. So yes, Locke gone, but not gone for sure.
So, of course, he's the heir to the Breen throne as well, this reluctant scion. Will he, if he comes back, when he comes back, Matt, take it over and be a voice, a force for change for good?
I mean, it feels like a very Star Trek thing to say, look, the Breen are so... aggressive and insular, et cetera, and here's a guy that went outside the walled garden, who met people that weren't like him, who learned to love, and he can come back and he can share that, and he can make the changes. Particularly if the plan was not, you know, and thus we set off the season 6 Breen War or whatever. Like, if regardless of who knew what was being written in relation to the cancellation or the unannounced canceling, blah, 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 to just, it's a better route to say this guy who checked out more experiences than that of his own community came back to his community with a better understanding and can spread that understanding and peace and dialogue and all of that. It's not the shiniest answer, you know, versus like, then we Top Gun jets fight, you know, but it's the Star Trek answer.
Now in the custody of the Breen, will they find out that Maul does not have a xenomorph egg in her sternum, but instead Locke's gelatinous offspring?
I think that's a very tempting story tool. I don't see a downside to it. If anything, I mean, to show what shows the common ground between those two peoples, then a common offspring and so forth. And again, while I'm not hearkening this show towards its end, you know, to me, it's a logical path to say next week is the fight to find the last piece, and the following week is the thing that you need to do to put it all together, and then obviously the whole thing gets resolved in the last episode. But you can't just do all that for three episodes. You need to have character stories and things of that sort, kind of more the emotional end versus the action end. And what you're describing is a very emotionally driven story point. So, hey, let's go for it.
Non says that she has a Romulan on her security team, but Navarre?
You're complaining that perhaps the show isn't being internally consistent. How about this, Pete? Non, who's from the 23rd century, talking to another lady from the 23rd century, they're kind of using, they're using the older terminology to just cut through all this 32nd century, you know, baloney and sit and go, it's a Romulan, it's totally cool.
I mean, I guess, wouldn't you, after a certain amount of time with two species that were already related to one another who have come back and reunified, no longer look at the difference between those two species? Like, you're not Vulcan, you're not Romulan, you're Navarran, right? Like, has it ever explicitly been stated, like, Tarina is Vulcan, she is Romulan? No, she's the president of Navarre, she's the president of a reunited people.
True, and have I watched all the Tarina episodes very recently? Are they fresh in my head? No, but I would say my impression is Navarre is still a divided place. I know that we had some of that kind of intrigue of, well, we're the logic extremists, we're the logic centrists, we're the emotional folks. So I think that if you want to say that maybe Vulcan and Romulan are less racial terms now, but more cultural descriptors of the Navarran people. Again, I think in the shorthand, it works.
We said that Doug Jones' unavailability for this and the previous couple episodes was because of a promotional tour for Hocus Pocus 2. Even though he's a little deeper down the bench in that project, but whatever. How about Rilik, Matt? You know, who is at Tellar Prime and just can't make it for this one. And, I have also, because I, President Tarina, am in the Toronto area right now, I have been delegated by President Rilik to be here today. You know, President Rilik sent me.
Pete, it had me wondering maybe some of those Firefly Lane episodes in which actress Chila Horsdahl plays Margie, maybe they were being filmed around this same time. I know, as you know, Pete, that some of the second half of season two of Firefly Lane came out in 2023, so not impossible that the filming was going around the same time. If nothing else, Pete, it goes to show the smarts of Discovery to have a bunch of great supporting characters and, frankly, a bunch of great women who can play leaders. Yes, it did cross my mind. Like, it's weird that the president of the Federation isn't here around, you know, isn't around for this. And it's weird that Saru's lady friend is the one who's going to represent, but Saru can't be here. If the answer is real world stuff, then that's when we all go, okay, cool, because they also explained it within the story, which is the president needs to be over there and Saru's over there, and what we got is what we got, and it works.
The Breen genocidal prime directive, how does that exactly square with joining with the Dominion?
Rayner's perspective isn't necessarily, you know, the objective truth. It does, certainly in that moment, he's trying to communicate that everybody else is not taking their threat as seriously as he believes they should. So I think that we can explain away your concern, Pete, with just the idea of the nuance that while they are more monstrous than perhaps the best optimists would believe, they're also perhaps not as the Breen in toto in this current situation are not as terrible as the experiences that Rayner has had.
What else is in a Seven of Limes?
Something glowing. maybe there's some salt on the rim. Maybe there's like some neat, I think of in our modern days, you can put little, frozen plastic doodads that you smack it and it lights up, like some stuff in there to be kind of Borgified lights and so forth. I bet that a Seven of Limes, you have one, you're feeling pretty good. You have two, you're just knocked out. I bet it's a powerful, powerful drink.
The answer we were looking for were nanites.
Ah, nanites. So close. So close.
The Eternal Gallery and Archive, Matt. Is this some kind of memory alpha?
yes, except everybody knows where memory alpha is, and that does not make a compelling story when instead you need to like track it down through the Badlands and get in there with your special key. Like, they need the Indiana Jonesification of it. So indeed, Pete, would I be shocked to hear this was originally pitched as Memory Alpha, as the planet Memory Alpha, but for story reasons we made it a reliquary that's constantly on the move because then it's more difficult to find. Sure, that works, Pete. I like living in a universe that has both. With that, let's open Hailing Frequencies.
Hailing Frequencies open, sir.
To Twitter we go, Pete, where we ran our standard ranking poll here. How many people voted it the Ensign Pip? 0%. As for Lieutenant, 8.3%. Commander, 33.3%. And then Captain, 58.3%. Some replies. First one here, it's Twitter Not Life at KCLYLE1. I'd give this 4 pips just for the Reno content alone. Pretty good episode. Aside from the Cerulousness, not sure I'm down with how easily Maul took out a group of trained security officers. Culber could have given her more trouble. Nice to see Nan back. We're definitely bringing Locke back, right? The idea of progenitor tech might bring back the dead has been mentioned too often, too. I see it used that way. Still no Detwo, that's your Detmer and Owo. Sad. It is what it is, I guess. And Pete, we've looked up their IMDBs and there isn't necessarily a smoking gun as to a major project that precluded them from this season, but certainly we'll hope that they've been busy working in higher profile, longer term, better paying spots, and we can still see them in one more curtain call before the series ends.
For sure.
One more tweet here, more poetry from Spider-Ham Lincoln at TessLC139. Episode 7 wasn't as great as some claim. Relax, Saru, Owo, Detmer. I feel your absence as the end draws near. Give more to Reno and less to book. Academy series will have which Discovery characters? Here's to a fantastic final 3 episodes. Pete, it's a fun game to play. Who's going to make it onto the Academy series as a regular, as a recurring, as a guest star? I mean, all bets are open, right? We haven't heard stories of people who've hated their time on Discovery, so opportunity plus pay plus schedule, you never know.
Yeah, bring them on. You got to wonder what kind of announcements might be made as we lead up to the finale for Starfleet Academy, or do they give it its own space and then, afterward start to make announcements as far as cast?
They've definitely said they're going to start filming this summer, right, Pete?
Yes.
So, I mean, I would just say, folks, let's approach this with yellow alert. First of all, what's the definition of summer, right? Okay, could be summer theoretically could be if they start filming the second week in September, it's still seasonal summer. Okay, fine. But as you're saying, Pete, you need casting announcements to roll into this. The closer we get into whatever we all want to define as summer, whether it's, June, July, or whatever it is, the closer we get to summer and we've heard nothing, the closer we get to the end of summer relative to what we've heard, relative to what the action is, we can start to see truth versus PR spin. Pete, what do you have over on your end?
On Reddit, Matt, a couple responses to our posting of the episode there. Several schooners said that that bombshell email from Paramount PR could be a big deal.
It was certainly quite a thing to see in the email box and quite a thing to reflect over.
Up Full Soul writes, great pod. I'll listen to your future episodes, to which I thanked him and was glad that he enjoyed it. And 200 Brews 2009 says, it was a good listen. Been following you guys since you started discussing new Trek. The bombshell, if true, is disheartening, but reflects what we've seen in the real world. Never seen a disco advert in the real world. Never seen one on any of the other streaming services. I've seen plenty of Prime adverts on HBO. Even within the Paramount app, I have to dig into it to find the latest episode on release day. None of the, quote, not ads, unquote, that they force on us, ad-free accounts before starting a show or movie was Star Trek related. I'm not sure if this is just Paramount not having the funds to properly market, them fumbling the marketing ball like everything else with Paramount Plus, or them hiring a, I'm editorializing here because of our Apple podcast rating, not good marketing company. Either way, it's a real disservice to the show and all the fans Star Trek has garnered over its decades and decades of shows.
I wonder, you know, I think back to the comment at the top of the podcast, how Shari Redstone really is valuing the sameness of the next chapter. You know, she wants to sell to somebody who's going to continue to do the same thing. How much of that permeates the culture of the company? Certainly there's many, many steps between the CEO and people making marketing decisions for Discovery, but how much of that, like, hey, cool kids around here who stick around and don't get fired, cool kids keep doing the same thing, don't go outside your lane too much, you know, how much of that is a corporate culture thing and just, you know, like, what, not listen to ad feedback or user feedback about the app? Why do that? Somebody, my boss told me the app is just fine. You know, things of that. I don't know. Maybe it's something that we'll never know, but it's just adds to the weirdness around these parts.
Not for nothing. Like, who makes that a point of your sale of a company? Like, I must approve of what you're going to do with the thing. Hey, Matt, you're going to buy my car, right? You're only going to keep this in a garage. Otherwise, I'm not going to sell it to you. Like, you just take the money. I get it. It's a legacy, but that person, that other entity could also lie to you. Oh, yeah, yeah, we're going to run it exactly like you. And then now I'm not.
Well, and I think I think that as complex as this corporate situation is, yeah, I think at least based on my, you know, meager reading of Deadline and Hollywood Reporter and Variety, yeah, I think that metaphor is perfect. Like, hey, before I sell you this classic car, you need to tell me how you're going to wax it every Saturday and keep it in.
Sure, exactly. Like, you did. How did you know? The same way.
But the difference being the minute, I don't know who in this metaphor is selling the car and who's buying, but the minute that the seller is like, oh, I don't know, maybe. Here are pictures of you on Instagram driving a car in the rain. Nope, we're not going to sell anymore. Like, that's part of the weirdness.
Oh, but you mean the car I now own? Like, how presumptuous is that?
Particularly, like, based on our understanding, Paramount is like $12 billion in debt and valued at somewhere in the $6 to $12 billion range. So their debt is at least equal to their value. This is a whole lot different than, you know, so it's like, I don't know how to turn that into the car metaphor. It's also rusting off. The wheels are rusting off. I'm not quite sure what that metaphor is, but like, there are problems here that maybe can only be solved with a major rewrite of what makes Paramount Global work. Certainly sitting and saying, well, we're just going to continue. We think that you're undervaluing MTV, Comedy Central, and BET. Oh, somebody wanted to buy BET last year for $1.5 billion. we think you're undervaluing it. Okay, keep losing money on these things. Even the Star Trek stuff. Like, we've all enjoyed this, and whatever the number is, 1/5 of all Paramount Plus users are here for Star Trek. Great. Paramount Plus is still not profitable. Period. I don't know how to square that circle, but to say, well, we're just going to do another year of it, but make less Star Trek when 20% of our users are here for Star Trek, I don't see how that makes sense. I'm not the one who's got billions of dollars to spend either, so whatever.
I like how Shari Redstone is employing brain negotiation tactics in the real world.
Yes, do this or else. Okay. Or else I'm Sony. I'll go back to making Ghostbusters and making Ted Lasso and making, you know, blah, 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 blah. Pete, shall we head to the email inbox?
Do it.
We heard from Dustin Bradford, who said, guys, pivotal episode with some serious stakes, but I came out with a couple of overwhelming impressions not really tied to the action or story. Tarina brought such a presence to the negotiating table. I really enjoyed her performance in the episode. She, with input from Burnham and Vance, brings Grand Admiral Thrawn level insight and conviction to the war room. I can't help but be... In fact, let me pause his words there for a moment. As I was reading that, I was thinking to myself, maybe Tarina is the best character to be doing these negotiations for the things that we talked about in the episode, but we were contrasting that with, like, why not use your president character? All due respect to the president character, to Sheila Horsdahl, who plays the president and so forth, I think Tarina is the better one here to not get ruffled and to be like, actually, maybe we're going to negotiate with your mom, mic drop. Like, Tarina maybe is the best one, and I think that's what Dustin is pointing out here.
Please, someone write that into dialogue.
All right, Ruin. Now your mom's gonna yell at you. Anyhow, back to Dustin's words.
There's the whole, Last Jedi line about, you know, Leia has a message, you know, about your mother, but, you know, negotiating with your mom might drop. Yeah, I need that.
Back to Dustin here says, I can't help but be distracted or even annoyed about something that has been normalized in Discovery, but especially noticeable in this episode. Is Michael Burnham the only character who can manage any interaction that includes Rayner, Book, Locke, Maul, or Nan? It's a strange through line for me, and her presence seems to be required for anything to get done right with any of those characters or with the Breen. She just beams from situation to situation, and it's written as though her presence is necessary for any situation to get resolved. It was refreshing and not lost on me that we got Tarina, Vance, Nan, and multiple Breen with lines and multiple character B and C plots in the same episode, and I especially enjoyed our early morning watch, especially when my wife called out Stamets for his impatience with Book and the library card. Wait till his forehead starts glowing, she yelled at the TV. Great observations there from Dustin. Thank you, Dustin. And I would agree, it's something that I think, you know, something I have phrased in prior podcasts as, you know, in a post Strange New Worlds, post Lower Decks scenario where you watch these Discovery episodes, it seems awfully old-fashioned to have your lead always be in the lead versus leaning into your ensemble.
Okay, but let's remember, she is an executive producer, okay? And as was Sir Patrick Stewart, okay? And that's a reality of show business that's really hard to shake. And the show's always been so central with her, particularly the advancement to captain rather than beginning the show as captain and gradually allowing other characters to develop more space. That I would say is just show business.
But is it to the improvement of the product? And again, I would completely agree with you, Pete. It's part and parcel for this show. And I'm not saying, you know, fundamentally change how this show is made up in season 5. But
it's a negotiation tactic as well. Like, it was such a big deal for Sinequa Martin Green to come to Star Trek from The Walking Dead. And to give her producer input, story input, And there's some back padding that goes on with that too. Like, oh, and then she needs to be here and then she needs to be there. You know, I knew her parents had passed away while they were filming season four. I had seen recently, like, they passed away, like, together nearly. And, you know, everything they had to do to accommodate her through that. I also feel like she's a really, really hardworking actress that wants to be super involved with this. I don't see it to detriment. I see it on the other way, like hands on, let's go. You know, she feels possessive of this in a creative way.
Well, Pete, ever creative in his input and his wisdom is Admiral Fred from the Netherlands, whose words we hear right now.
Hello, Matt and Pete and all listeners to Fantastic Geek. This is Fred from the Netherlands with a little feedback for Star Trek Discovery Season 5, Episode 7. Wow, this was much better than last week. I will come to that later. First off, I want to tell you I started after finishing Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., seeing the whole series, with a rewatch of Jessica Jones. And that's because I only saw the first season and now I'm rewatching that so that I can watch the second and third season and Luke Cage as well. So a lot of listening to Fantastic Geek ahead. I loved the actually love story between Maul and Locke. Her devotion to him is incredible. And in the end, it proved that they even are kind of married. I really wonder if he will be brought back to life. Obviously, being a kind of crown prince to the Breen Empire. I hadn't seen Locke's death coming. I thought he would survive with the Breen doctor there, but just barely. On the other hand, now it gets interesting. I really liked the, well, I disliked actually, but really liked the Breen, how they perform. They really feel like a genuine threat, much better than Maul and Locke on their own before. They were all the time adversaries, but not the strongest ones. That Dreadnought was really impressive. And then when the cavalry comes, so Starfleet sends four ships, they're just so tiny if you compare them to the Dreadnought. So I really wonder if they could have made a real difference. When Tarina was mentioning Saru, I really was expecting that he would pop up. I love the fight scenes in this episode and the action, just enough and not too much. Okay, that will be all. Greetings. All the best, Fred from the Netherlands.
Pete, it warms the heart to hear that Fred is enjoying our back catalog, particularly stuff in the Marvel Netflix era. When you were talking at the top of the podcast about the possibility of Sigourney Weaver joining the Mandalorian and Grogu movie, I was reminded of, you know, her being brought out at New York Comic Con, being part of the Defenders miniseries, which...
Seeing the roof blown off the main stage.
And it was the best moment from the Defenders miniseries was when we were there, when she was announced that she was cast in it, and everything else was kind of downhill from there.
Fred makes a good point here. While Locke's return is anticipated, that we didn't see the death coming. So, yeah, like that.
Well, Pete, listeners have made it to this near end point of the episode, but some goodies about to be given away. Do you want to go first or should I go first?
Let's build up to the drawing here for our winner's choice of either a 4K Blu-ray or a traditional Blu-ray for Falcon and the Winter Soldier, Moon Knight, Obi-Wan Kenobi, or Andor.
Well, on this end, Pete, we've been doing Discovery t-shirts and one each week and so forth, giving out to those who support us on Patreon. And I have the wheel of names here, spinning. It has landed on Ryan. It's aka Trek and Tech. So I'll be reaching out to Ryan soon for Ryan to pick out a t-shirt that we can send along to him ASAP. So congrats, Ryan.
There you go. And Matt, ultimately we had 8 people either join Patreon or upgrade their membership for this promotion. And I'm very happy to announce that Derek O'Neill is the winner of either the 4K or the traditional Blu-ray. So Derek, we're going to be in touch and find out what your choice is. And then you're going to get that in the mail.
Congrats there, Derek, and all this made possible by those who support us on patreon.com/fantasticgeek. So thank you again, one and all, for keeping us listener supported.
Everybody who contributes gets access to exclusive content, all sorts of levels to choose from, but it takes just $1 a month to get you behind that door. Can't contribute right now? Get yourself over to Apple Podcasts. Leave us a rating. Leave us a review to any of our 35 Matt podcast feeds. Could really use some for the Acolyte as we're heading into that June 4th 2-episode premiere.
And indeed, Pete, let's keep the Star Trek conversation going. Let's keep the Star Wars conversation going. How can people be in touch with you on social media?
You can find me on Twitter, on Threads, on Blue Sky, at Peter, PieterJKetelaar, KetelaaR, 12,600 followers. Can't be wrong.
And while I'm personally on Twitter, looking back lost, do be in touch with the podcast. Comment on fantasticgeek.com. Check us out on Twitter, Instagram, Gmail, and Threads, where we are Fantastic Geek as well. But wait, Pete, there's more.
Facebook.com/FantasticGeek with the PH, all one word, like it today.
We will be back next Star Trek Sunday to discuss the 8th episode of the 5th and final season of Star Trek Discovery. Certainly more Acolyte discussion in the near future as well. For now, though, Pete, I will say adios to all our listeners and give you the final word.
This bluff wouldn't fool a hatchling.